A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's in the middle of moving apartments, and it's been one of those weeks where every retailer seems to be testing how much frustration a human being can absorb before they just give up and live in an empty apartment. He ordered a fiber optic modem from the biggest big box tech store in the country. Website said in stock. His wife goes to pick it up. Turns out they don't have it. Then he orders a platform trolley from one of the biggest online hardware stores. It doesn't ship for a week. When they finally call, they explain the delivery point couldn't accept the size. They're sending it to the house instead, and they won't let him cancel. And they don't answer their phone. His call question is, in a market of 10 million people where retailers know you've got almost nowhere else to go, what actually stops them from treating you badly? And how have other small market countries solved this problem?
The thing that jumps out at me immediately is the cancellation refusal. That's not just bad service, that's a specific legal question. In most developed consumer protection regimes, if you order something online and it hasn't shipped within a reasonable window, you have a statutory right to cancel and get a refund. The fact that a major retailer in Israel feels comfortable just saying no and then not answering the phone tells you something about enforcement reality versus what's written in the law books.
And Daniel's observation, which I think is the sharpest part of this prompt, is that the specialist stores don't do this. He orders Ubiquiti routers from niche tech suppliers. The order value might be lower, but the experience is night and day. His theory is that specialist retailers operate in a word-of-mouth economy where every transaction represents a meaningful fraction of their addressable market. The big box stores have done the math and concluded that losing one customer who's moving apartments doesn't move the needle.
Which is the paradox of the captive market in a nutshell. The thing that's supposed to discipline bad behavior, voting with your wallet, stops working when there are only three wallets to vote with, and all three of them are equally indifferent to your existence.
The question becomes, if the market can't self-correct, what does the law do about it? And is anyone actually doing it well?
That's exactly where I want to take this. Because there are jurisdictions with populations under 6 million that have built enforcement mechanisms that genuinely change retailer behavior. Singapore, New Zealand, Norway. Different legal traditions, different approaches, but they've all solved the same core problem. How do you make consumer protection law something retailers actually fear, rather than something they budget for as a cost of doing business?
The personal story matters here because it's not theoretical. Daniel is standing in an apartment with no modem and no trolley, and the law, whatever it says on paper, is not helping him. So let's figure out why, and what a functioning alternative looks like.
Let's start with the structural diagnosis, because the problem isn't that Israel lacks consumer protection law on paper. The consumer protection law of 1981 is actually reasonably comprehensive. It covers misleading advertising, it covers cancellation rights for distant selling, it covers product conformity and warranty obligations. The issue is entirely in the enforcement architecture.
The law says one thing, the phone gets put down on you, and those two realities never meet.
And the mechanism that's supposed to connect them. The Consumer Protection Authority had roughly 40 inspectors for the entire country as of 2024. That's one inspector for every 250,000 people. A Knesset committee hearing in 2023 revealed they could only investigate about 12% of formal complaints. The other 88% just sit in a database.
The deterrent effect is essentially zero. If you're a big box retailer and you know there's an 88% chance nothing happens when you refuse a cancellation, you factor that into your operations. It's not malice, it's arithmetic.
And this connects directly to what makes small markets different. In a market of 330 million, even a retailer with significant market share faces a meaningful threat from competitors. In a market of 10 million, where electronics retail has a Herfindahl-Hirschman concentration score of roughly 2,800, that's highly concentrated by U.S. Department of Justice standards, consumers have few alternatives. The exit option is theoretical.
That's the specialist store inside, Daniel flagged. A niche ubiquity supplier isn't competing in a market of 10 million. They're competing in a market of maybe 5,000 serious networking enthusiasts in the country. One bad experience documented on a forum can cost them 5-10% of their addressable market. The incentives flip completely.
Which reveals something important about enforcement design. You don't necessarily need more inspectors if you can make the complaint process itself so low friction that retailers factor resolution costs into every transaction. I think of effective consumer protection as resting on three pillars: clear statutory rights that consumers can actually understand without a lawyer, complaint mechanisms that don't require 6 months of your life and 3 in-person appearances, and enforcement that creates real deterrence, meaning the penalty for non-compliance exceeds the profit from non-compliance.
That third one sounds obvious, but it's where most systems fail. The 2024 case where a major Israeli electronics retailer was fined 2.5 million shekels for deceptive pricing made headlines. Sounds like a lot. Until you realize it was roughly 0.03% of their annual revenue. That's not a deterrent. That's a rounding error with a press release.
That's the framework I want to use for the rest of this episode. First, we'll dig into why Israel's system specifically fails across all three of those pillars: the statutory gaps, the procedural friction, the weak deterrence. Then we'll look at three jurisdictions that have solved different pieces of this puzzle: Singapore, New Zealand, and Norway. They're all small markets, populations between 5 and 6 million, but they've built enforcement mechanisms that actually change retailer behavior.
The goal isn't just to compare legal systems for the sake of it. The question is, what design principles actually work? What makes a retailer in Singapore answer the phone when a retailer in Tel Aviv doesn't?
Spoiler, it's not that Singaporean retailers are more virtuous. It's that the system makes good behavior the profit-maximizing strategy. Let's start with the diagnosis. Let's start with what Israel's consumer protection law actually says about cancellation. Section 14C, which covers distance selling, gives you 14 days to cancel an order and get a refund. That's the law on paper. The problem is, what happens when the retailer just ignores it?
Which is what happened here. The hardware store didn't dispute the law, they just didn't pick up the phone.
That's the enforcement gap in its purest form. The Consumer Protection Authority has about 40 inspectors for 10 million people. That Knesset hearing in 2023, where the director admitted they investigate 12% of complaints, that number stuck with me because it means the system is essentially operating on an honor code for retailers who are not honorable.
The rational retailer calculation is, even if this customer files a formal complaint, there's an 88% chance the government never looks at it. And the remaining 12% chance probably results in a warning letter.
Now, Israel does have a class action mechanism under the Class Actions Law of 2006, and it's actually relatively permissive compared to some jurisdictions. You can file for things like deceptive practices, failure to disclose, breach of statutory duty. But here's the catch. Certification is hard, the cases drag on for years, and the average payout per class member is often under 50 shekels.
About $13. So even when the system works, the individual consumer gets lunch money, and the retailer writes a check that doesn't change their behavior.
And that's the deterrence problem in a nutshell. The fine we mentioned, 2.5 million shekels in 2024 for deceptive pricing, that's the headline. But when you do the math, it's 0.03% of annual revenue. If you're a retailer and the cost of complying with the law is higher than the cost of occasionally getting fined, the rational business decision is to keep doing what you're doing. I'm reminded of the Ford Pinto case from the 1970s, where internal memos revealed Ford had calculated that paying out wrongful death lawsuits was cheaper than recalling the vehicles and fixing the fuel tank design. That's the same arithmetic at a much more horrifying scale, and it's the same logic. When the penalty is cheaper than the fix, the penalty becomes the fix.
That's a chilling parallel, but it's exactly right. And this is where the specialist store comparison becomes so instructive. Daniel's ubiquity supplier isn't more ethical in some abstract sense. They've just done a different calculation. Their addressable market is maybe 5,000 serious networking buyers in the country. One bad review on a forum reaches a significant chunk of that audience. The customer lifetime value math flips. Losing one customer suddenly matters. If that one customer represents, say, 2% of their annual revenue instead of 0.0001%, Suddenly, the calculus of ignoring a complaint looks like business suicide rather than a rounding error.
Which brings me to a concept I think is useful here, enforcement elasticity. How responsive are retailers to the threat of legal consequences? In Israel, the small claims court handles claims up to 34,000 shekels, and the filing fee is 1% of the claim value. That sounds accessible. But the process takes 6 to 12 months and requires in-person appearances. For a 200 shekel platform trolley, you're looking at a 2 shekel filing fee and half a day off work.
The math collapses immediately. You're not recovering 200 shekels. You're spending 400 shekels worth of your time to maybe recover 200 shekels 6 months from now. The rational consumer gives up. And retailers know the rational consumer gives up. It's like building a bridge where the toll booth charges more than the destination is worth. Nobody's going to cross it, and the people who built it know nobody's going to cross it.
That's the procedural friction problem. The law technically provides a remedy, but the remedy is designed in a way that makes pursuing it economically irrational for most disputes. And this is where the international comparisons get interesting, because Singapore, New Zealand, and Norway all attack this exact problem, not by making the fines bigger, but by making the process faster and cheaper.
Before we get to those, I want to sit with the HHI numbers for a moment, because they explain why the just shop somewhere else. Advice doesn't work here. Electronics retail at 2,800, home goods at 3,200. These are US Department of Justice, highly concentrated territory. In a market that concentrated, the big players don't need to compete on service. They compete on location and inventory breadth, and service is a cost center they can safely neglect. It's the retail equivalent of an airline knowing you're stuck in their hub city. Sure, you could drive 6 hours to the next airport, but you won't.
That's the captive market dynamic in its purest form. The consumer's threat to take their business elsewhere is hollow because elsewhere is two other chains running the same playbook. The only retailers who break the pattern are the specialists, and they break it precisely because they're not playing the same game. Their market is smaller, their reputation more fragile, their incentives align differently.
We've got a law that looks reasonable on paper, an enforcement agency that can't enforce, a class action system that produces tiny payouts after years of litigation, and a small claims process that makes pursuing a complaint economically irrational. The retailer who doesn't answer the phone isn't being irrational. They're reading the landscape correctly.
That's the diagnosis. Now the question is, what does a functioning alternative look like? Let's start with Singapore. Population 5.6 million, even smaller than Israel, and with a retail market that's similarly concentrated in key sectors. The Consumer Protection Fair Trading Act of 2003 is their framework, enforced by the Competition and Consumer Commission of Singapore, the CCCS. But here's the mechanism that actually changes behavior. The CCCS can issue what's called a voluntary compliance agreement. A retailer agrees to stop a specific practice, and that agreement becomes legally binding. Breach it, and you're in court on a contempt basis, not a fresh investigation.
It's a shortcut. Instead of building a full prosecution from scratch, they get the retailer to sign a piece of paper that says, "We won't do this anymore," and then if they do it again, the enforcement machinery is already loaded. It's like giving a shoplifter a trespass notice. The first offense gets documented, and the second one escalates immediately without having to reprove the whole pattern of behavior.
And the small claims tribunals are the other piece. Claims under 20,000 Singapore dollars, about 15,000 US, processed with a median resolution time of 28 days. That's less than a credit card billing cycle. A retailer knows that if they sell you a defective product, you can have a tribunal order in your hand before your statement arrives.
28 days. Compare that to 6 to 12 months in Israel. That's not a difference of degree. That's a difference of kind. The retailer's calculation flips because the consequence is immediate. If you know the customer can have a binding order against you in less than a month, you answer the phone on day 3 because the alternative is spending day 28 writing a check that's bigger than the refund would have been.
Singapore added a crucial amendment in 2012, their Lemon Law provisions. For motor vehicles and electronics, there's a presumption of non-conformity within 6 months of purchase. The burden of proof shifts to the retailer. If your laptop fails at month 4, the law assumes it was defective when you bought it unless the retailer can prove otherwise.
which is the exact opposite of the typical consumer experience, where you're the one trying to prove you didn't drop it in the bathtub. There was a case in 2023. A major electronics chain had to replace a laptop that failed after 14 months, well beyond the standard warranty. The CCCS determined that the expected lifespan of a laptop at that price point was 4 years, and 14 months fell short of reasonable durability.
That's the acceptable quality concept in action, and it's powerful because it doesn't tie consumer rights to the manufacturer's warranty period. It ties them to what a reasonable person would expect. Think about that. A $2,000 laptop that dies at 14 months. The manufacturer's one-year warranty says you're out of luck, but a reasonable person expects a $2,000 machine to last more than a year and change. Singapore's framework says the reasonable person wins.
That reasonable person standard is deceptively radical. It takes the warranty document, which the consumer never reads and has no power to negotiate, and says this piece of paper doesn't define your rights. Community expectations define your rights. New Zealand does this even more aggressively. The Consumer Guarantees Act of 1993 defines acceptable quality by what a reasonable consumer would consider acceptable, not by what the spec sheet says, not by what the warranty covers. And their disputes tribunal handles claims up to 30,000 New Zealand dollars, about 18,000 US, with no lawyers allowed.
That's the detail that makes me sit up. The entire asymmetry of consumer disputes is that the retailer can afford legal counsel and the consumer can't. Remove lawyers from the equation and suddenly the playing field is level.
This is one of those design choices that seems small but changes everything. Think about what a lawyer does in a dispute. They proceduralize it. They file motions, they request adjournments, they turn a simple question of, did the product work or not, into a 6-month paper war. The consumer shows up with a receipt and a broken toaster. The retailer's lawyer shows up with a binder full of technical specifications and case law. The tribunal referee is supposed to balance these, but the asymmetry is baked in from the start. New Zealand just said, nobody gets a lawyer. You both walk in, you both tell your story, the referee decides. It's not perfect, but it's fast and it's cheap, and the retailer can't win by outspending you.
Filing fee for claims under 2,000 New Zealand dollars is $45, about 27 US. Target resolution time is 6 weeks, and the Commerce Commission has real teeth under the Fair Trading Act. They prosecuted a furniture retailer in 2024 for misleading consumers about delivery times, and the penalty included a requirement to display corrective notices in all stores for 6 months.
Which costs them more in lost goodwill than the fine itself. That's the reputational multiplier we've been circling. In a market of 5 million, a corrective notice in every store window reaches a meaningful percentage of your customer base. It's not just a line item on a financial statement. It's a public shaming mechanism that directly impacts foot traffic.
Norway takes yet another approach. Population 5.4 million. The Consumer Council, Forbrukerdet, isn't just a complaint handler, it's a quasi-legal advocate. They can bring representative actions, they negotiate directly with companies, and they've got the institutional credibility to make threats that retailers take seriously. In 2020, they forced Apple to pay compensation for throttled iPhones, the Batterygate settlement, and the Norwegian payout was one of the most generous globally.
There's a 2022 case where they forced a telecom provider to retroactively apply a price reduction to all existing customers when they introduced a cheaper plan. Not just new customers, everyone. That's the kind of intervention that changes how companies design their pricing strategies in the first place. The telecom's marketing team now has to factor in, if we drop the price for new subscribers, are we prepared to give that price to every existing subscriber too? It changes the internal modeling before the ad ever goes live.
Their Consumer Disputes Commission processes cases with a median of 3 months and a 70% success rate for consumers. 42,000 complaints processed in 2024. That scale. That's a system that's actually functioning as a consumer backstop, not as a symbolic gesture.
What's the common thread across Singapore, New Zealand, and Norway? It's not that their consumer protection laws are more comprehensive on paper. Israel's 1981 law covers much of the same ground. The difference is enforcement mechanism design. Singapore's 28-day tribunal turnaround, New Zealand's no lawyers rule, and $45 filing fee. Norway's consumer counsel acting as an advocate rather than a passive complaint box.
Each of them solved a different piece of the friction problem. Singapore solves speed. The retailer knows the reckoning arrives before the credit card bill. New Zealand solved cost and asymmetry. No lawyers, minimal fees, so the consumer's threat to escalate is credible. Norway solved institutional weight. The Consumer Council has the standing and resources to go after Apple, not just the corner store.
In all three cases, the retailer's rational calculation changes. It's not that Norwegian or Singaporean businesses are more ethical. It's that the system makes good behavior cheaper than bad behavior. When a complaint can be resolved in 28 days with no lawyers and a $45 fee, ignoring the customer stops being the profit-maximizing strategy. It becomes the profit-destroying strategy.
That's the design principle worth underlining. You don't need to make retailers afraid of massive fines. You need to make them afraid of the small, fast, inevitable ones. A $50 refund processed through a tribunal that costs the retailer $200 in staff time to contest is a net loss. Multiply that by 1,000 customers who now know the tribunal exists, and the math flips hard.
I want to pause on that point because it's counterintuitive. The instinct in consumer protection reform is always make the penalties bigger. Headline, grabbing fines. But the Singapore and New Zealand approach suggests the opposite. Make the penalties smaller but certain. A retailer can budget for a once every 5 years $2 million fine. They can't budget for 500 tribunal claims a month at $200 each in administrative costs. The frequency is the deterrent, not the size.
That's the enforcement elasticity concept again. Frequent, low-cost enforcement changes daily behavior. Rare, high-cost enforcement changes press release strategy. And if you're a consumer standing in an empty apartment with no modem, you don't care about the press release strategy.
What do you actually do with all of this if you're listening in a small market and you've just had your own platform trolley moment? First thing, figure out whether your jurisdiction has a small claims tribunal or disputes process and learn its actual rules. Most people assume legal recourse is expensive. In New Zealand, filing a claim under $2,000 costs 45 New Zealand dollars. That's about 27 US dollars. You don't need a lawyer. You fill out a form, show up, and the whole thing is designed to resolve in 6 weeks.
The barrier isn't the law. It's the assumption that the law isn't for you. That assumption is wrong in a lot more places than people realize. And retailers benefit from that assumption. They want you to think the legal system is an impenetrable fortress, because every consumer who believes that is a consumer who won't file.
Second, the specialist store heuristic. This is the practical shopping strategy that emerged from Daniel's observation, and it's useful. In a concentrated market, prioritize retailers where your individual transaction represents a meaningful fraction of their monthly revenue. A niche ubiquity supplier who sells to maybe 5,000 enthusiasts in the whole country treats every order like it matters because every order does matter. Their customer lifetime value calculation includes the forum post you might write.
It's not about finding ethical retailers. It's about finding retailers whose incentives are aligned with yours. The specialist business model depends on not being the subject of a Reddit thread titled, "Avoid this vendor." And in a small market, that Reddit thread might be the top Google result for their company name within a week.
Third, for anyone who wants to push for reform, the most effective consumer protection improvements are not about increasing fines. They're about reducing friction. Singapore's 28-day small claims target and New Zealand's no lawyers rule are the models worth advocating for. You don't need to rewrite the entire consumer protection code. You need one procedural reform that makes the threat of escalation credible.
The reputation multiplier in small markets is a natural enforcement mechanism that's already working. A single negative Google review in a market of 10 million reaches roughly 2 to 3% of your potential customer base within a year. In a market of 330 million, it's more like 0.1%. The same review is 20 to 30 times more damaging in a small market, and retailers who ignore that are leaving money on the table.
Which means consumers in small markets actually have more leverage than they think. They just need to use it systematically. Leave the review. File the tribunal claim. The math works differently here, and once retailers internalize that, the phone starts getting answered.
There's one question that's been nagging at me through this whole discussion, and it's about where this is all heading. AI-powered customer service chatbots are becoming ubiquitous. And I mean actually ubiquitous, not just the clunky menu trees we've had for years. A capable language model sitting between you and any human who could escalate your complaint.
The friction barrier gets higher, not lower. A chatbot never gets frustrated, never has a bad day, never accidentally admits the company messed up. It just loops through apologetic variations until you give up. It's the customer service equivalent of a wall that's soft to lean against but impossible to break through.
And that's the enforcement problem of the future. The current system assumes a human eventually picks up the phone. If the AI layer becomes the permanent interface, not a routing mechanism, but a containment strategy, then even the most well-designed small claims tribunal can't help you, because you never reach a human who can authorize the refund you're legally entitled to.
The EU's Digital Markets Act and Digital Services Act are starting to build frameworks for this. Platform accountability, transparency requirements, mandatory escalation paths. The question is whether small markets piggyback on those standards or try to develop their own.
My bet is piggybacking. Norway already aligns heavily with EU consumer frameworks despite not being a member. Singapore watches EU and UK developments closely. New Zealand has a history of adapting successful models from elsewhere. Small markets don't need to invent, they need to adopt and adapt fast.
Which brings me to the final thought I want to land. Daniel's observation that they don't give a crap. That's not a moral failure. It's a rational response to misaligned incentives. The entire goal of good consumer protection law is to make giving a crap the profit-maximizing strategy. When Singapore makes a retailer replace a 14-month-old laptop because the expected lifespan is 4 years, they're not appealing to the retailer's better nature. They're changing the math.
That's the systemic insight. Individual horror stories feel personal, but they're not. They're the predictable output of a system where the incentives point toward indifference. Fix the incentives, and the behavior follows. Not because retailers become nicer people, but because nice becomes cheaper. That's the quiet genius of what Singapore, New Zealand, and Norway have done. They didn't try to make corporations virtuous. They made it so that virtue is the path of least resistance.
One open question I'll leave listeners with. If AI chatbots become the default customer service layer, does that concentrate or diffuse consumer power? On one hand, a chatbot that never escalates is a brick wall. On the other hand, a chatbot generates a searchable transcript of every interaction, which is evidence that doesn't currently exist when you call and get hung up on. Right now, if a retailer's phone agent tells you, "We don't do refunds," and hangs up, you have no record. If a chatbot types, "We don't do refunds," into a chat window, you have a screenshot that's admissible in a tribunal. The same technology that frustrates you might also arm you.
That's an interesting tension. The same technology that could make enforcement harder could also make it easier to prove non-compliance. Depends entirely on whether regulators require those transcripts to be preserved and accessible. And that's a policy choice, not a technological inevitability. A small market could pass a regulation tomorrow saying any AI chatbot deployed for customer service must retain full transcripts for 12 months and make them available to the consumer on request. Suddenly, the containment wall becomes a paper trail.
Something to watch. For now, if you're in a small market and you've just been told no by a retailer who knows you have nowhere else to go, the law might actually be on your side. The question is whether the enforcement mechanism makes that law real. And in too many places, it still doesn't. But the models exist. Singapore built speed. New Zealand built accessibility. Norway built institutional muscle. None of these required rewriting human nature. They just required rewriting the incentives.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this show running. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com, and if you've got a consumer protection story or a platform trolley that finally arrived, we'd love to hear it.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host digging, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.